Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the February 23rd edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. You remember Condoleezza Rice, President Bush's Secretary of State? In July 2006, after meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert in Jerusalem, she told the press that Washington had, quote, no desire to come back in months or weeks to deal with another Hezbollah uprising. It is time, she said, for a new Middle East. Part of the plan to achieve that, of course, had been the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which was sold to the American people and the world as a necessity to prevent Saddam Hussein from using his weapons of mass destruction. We all know now what many of us suspected then. We had no WMDs, but he was determined to have that war. Today, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Susan Lindauer, a former anti-war activist who became a paid U.S. government asset whose efforts to stop the war in Iraq led to her spending a year in federal prison for her efforts, a victim of the U.S. Patriot Act. She has written and self-published a remarkable book about her experiences entitled Extreme Prejudice. Hers is an extraordinary story, and that's what we will be talking about later. Meanwhile, there is a new Middle East, but I doubt very much if it's the kind Rice, Washington, or the Israeli government had in mind. Rice hadn't counted on a 26-year-old Tunisian street vendor, Mohamed Bouazi, who, unable to find a job and harassed by the Tunisian police, committed suicide on 17 December by setting himself alight in front of a regional governor's office in the North African country. That act of desperation triggered protests in several cities, especially after one protester was shot by the police, which the Tunisian Ministry of Interior claimed was an act of self-defense. In an attempt to contain the crisis, the Tunisian government minister announced the launch of several projects worth a total of $15 million U.S. and distributed financial grants and donations to 750 local families. He attempted to sweeten the pot by accepting 1,300 applications for government jobs that had been submitted by local university graduates who needed them, but it was too late. Bouazi's death became the catalyst for a number of deadly demonstrations throughout Tunisia that eventually led President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali to step down on January 14th after 23 years in power. And that was just the beginning. The success of the Tunisian protests sparked an unprecedented uprising, an Arab awakening across the North African Maghreb, as several more men in their countries emulated Bouazi's act. The largest protest, as we saw, took place in Egypt, the region's most populated country, where millions turned out in the streets and refused to be turned back by the violence unleashed on them by supporters of President dictator Hosni Mubarak. After 18 days, their courage and persistence proved to be too much for the Egyptian army, whose ranks are filled with conscripts drawn from Egyptian society. Its leading generals, realizing the troops would not fire on the people, then pressured Mubarak to step down, bringing to a sudden end on February 11th the 30-year reign of Washington and Israel's most solid Arab ally. It was not, as the popular story now goes, however, a totally nonviolent rebellion. When Mubarak's special police, many dressed in plain clothes, began attacking the crowds in Tahrir Square several days after the protests began, a number of the protesters started breaking up paving stones and turned into weapons whatever they could find on the streets, and they fought back and drove the attackers off. Thanks to Al Jazeera, this was seen all over the world and led President Obama to call his friend Mubarak and tell him the violence had to stop, but the president did not make a demand at that point for him to step down. With Al Jazeera following the action and armed with Facebook, Twitter, cell phones, and YouTube, protests initiated by the youth but quickly involving all levels of Arab society have continued in Bahrain, Jordan, Algeria, and Yemen, all of them in different but important ways, critical to continuing U.S. hegemony over the region. One country that has yet to experience protests is Saudi Arabia, but it is reported that it was the Saudis that dictated the first harsh responses by the rulers of Bahrain to the protesters in that tiny island nation that is home to the U.S. Fifth Fleet and whose army is composed of foreign mercenaries. While the population of Bahrain is 70% Shia, the ruling family is Sunni, as is that of the Saudis, who have a causeway that connects them to the island. The Saudi monarchy is particularly concerned because its Shia minority is located in the country's major oil-producing region. On Sunday, Saudi Arabia said that it stands ready, quote, with all its capabilities, end quote, to shore up Bahrain's ruling royal family if a standoff with the Shia-led opposition is not resolved soon. Saudi Arabia props up Bahrain's Al Khalifa family with cash and has long sought to prevent the tiny Persian Gulf state from falling into Iran's orbit. The Saudi monarchy must not have looked with favor on Iran's Press TV television station, which on the day of the most violent crackdown on the Shia protesters devoted its entire programming to depicting the carnage in the streets. Now it has been announced that Bahrain has released 50 political prisoners, and the Saudi monarch King Abdullah has announced that Social Security benefits would be increased and new public housing would be constructed. They are clearly worried. Within the past week, however, most of the world's attention would be focused on a country that isn't, or at least not so overtly, in the U.S. stable. That's Libya, where Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's 42-year reign has been challenged by the Libyan people, and the Libyan dictator has not welcomed it. Shocked by the brutal and ruthless manner in which Gaddafi has tried to quell the rebellion, sections of the army have gone over to the side of the people. Pilots ordered to bomb the people have defected, and most of the country's entire diplomatic corps, including Libya's UN delegation, has resigned, accusing Gaddafi of genocide. On Monday, there were rumors that Gaddafi had hopped a plane to Venezuela and would seek asylum from his friend Hugo Chavez, but Venezuela denied that, and as of yesterday, the mercurial colonel had still not left the country. Moreover, in a TV appearance, he accused foreign forces of being behind the protest and threatened the Libyan people with further bloodshed. Speculation that he would seek refuge in Venezuela probably stemmed from a meeting held there in September 2009, at which, according to the LA Times, Gaddafi and the Venezuelan president urged nearly 30 leaders from Africa and South America to form a strong intercontinental alliance to press their mutual interests. Gaddafi called for the two regions to become a political and economic force, saying, quote, "We can transform the world," end quote. He proposed a defense alliance of South American and African nations akin to NATO, an idea Chavez had previously raised. The Venezuelan president pledged to put up funding to help create a South American African Development Bank. If it happens, it is likely Chavez will need a new partner. The lifting of the sanctions applied against Libya after Gaddafi paid millions of dollars to the families of those killed in the Lockerbie bombing was welcomed by European countries and businesses, as well as U.S. oil companies, that were anxious to get their hands on Libya's oil reserves, which at an estimated 44 million barrels is considered to be the largest in Africa. It has also attracted the attention of another fellow with whose name you political junkies are likely to be familiar, Richard Perle, the former Reagan-era Defense Department official and George W. Bush-era chairman of the Defense Policy Board, who came to be known in Washington as the Prince of Darkness. In the mid-90s, he became a prominent member of the Project for New American Century and was a co-author of a document entitled A Clean Break, which called on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in his first term to launch a war to take out Saddam Hussein and to end negotiations for giving up any territory to the Palestinians. Yesterday, Laura Rosen, writing on the political blog, reported that Perle traveled to Libya twice in 2006 to meet with Gaddafi and afterward briefed Vice President Dick Cheney on his visits. Perle traveled to Libya as a paid senior advisor to the Monitor Group, a prestigious Boston-based consulting firm with close ties to leading professors at the Harvard Business School. According to the group, Perle's travel to Libya and the recruitment of several other prominent thinkers and former officials were designed to burnish Libya's and Gaddafi's image. Although there is one country frequently in the news that may be next to explode, and that is Pakistan, where Washington and Islamabad, or perhaps more accurately, Lahore, are battling over the fate of an American calling himself Raymond A. Davis, who murdered two Pakistanis in Lahore, who he maintains attempted to rob him. According to press reports, the two were on a motorcycle that drew up next to his car, but he shot each of them five times, including in the back, through his front windshield. The pictures were carried on television. Each man was carrying a gun, but that's not unusual in Pakistan, but neither apparently had drawn or fired them. To compound the situation, another U.S. vehicle that Davis had called to extricate him himself from the situation, an SUV, ran over and killed another motorcyclist and then left the scene before he could be arrested. That driver has left the country. In Davis's car, the police found two handguns, a great deal of ammunition, several cell phones, a telescope, and a camera containing pictures of a large number of madrasas or religious schools. President Obama publicly claimed that Davis is a member of the American Diplomatic Corps and as such enjoys diplomatic immunity and should immediately be freed. Last week, he sent his emissary, Senator John Kerry, ambling over to Pakistan to stress the American position. He didn't get very far. Instead of releasing the so-called Davis, the court in Lahore said it would not make a decision on the case until March 14th. In the meantime, thousands of protesters have marched in the streets of Lahore and elsewhere in Pakistan, demanding that Davis be tried for murder. It seems they have a much stronger case than Washington, which, other than its prestige as a superpower and major funder of the Pakistani economy and army, has, in fact, no case at all. First, forget what you heard this morning on Morning Edition. International law that deals with diplomatic immunity does not apply to capital cases, which this clearly is. Why hasn't the U.S. media mentioned that? You could tell me. Second, the evidence that Davis is a member of the U.S. Diplomatic Corps is very shaky. On the Senate floor last week, in which there was a debate over whether or not the U.S. should suspend aid to Pakistan over this issue, Senator Lindsey Graham gave the game away. "We can't throw this agent over," he said. "I don't know all the details, but we cannot define the relationship based on one incident because it's too important at a time when we're making progress in Afghanistan." That was in keeping with a number of stories published in Pakistan and on the web, and finally in the New York Times yesterday, that Davis is a CIA agent, a former Blackwater employee, and part of a team of CIA agents working covertly, quote, from the New York Times, conducting surveillance and collecting intelligence on militant groups, end quote, according to U.S. government officials, which makes the president out to be a liar. I don't know if he was doing surveillance, why he needed all those guns, but that's another story. On January 25, 2011, just 2 days before Davis shot and killed the two young Pakistanis, the U.S. Embassy submitted a list of its diplomatic and non-diplomatic staff in Pakistan to the Pakistani Foreign Office, as all foreign nations are required to do annually. The list included 48 names. Of course, Raymond Davis was not on the list. The day after he shot and killed two Pakistanis, the U.S. Embassy suddenly submitted a revised list to the Foreign Office, and there was Davis's name. When Pakistani police took Davis into custody on January 27th, he had on his person an ordinary American passport with a valid ordinary Pakistan visa issued by the Pakistan Embassy in Washington. The next day, a member of the U.S. consulate wanted the Pakistan police to exchange that passport in Davis's possession with another one. The fresh passport offered was a diplomatic passport with a valid diplomatic visa dated sometime in 2009. This visa was stamped in Islamabad by the Pakistan Foreign Office. The problem facing Washington and Islamabad is this. If Pakistan allows Davis to be released without trial, it is very likely to stir a revolt in that country that will make the uprisings thus far appear to be so many garden parties, and Pakistan has a number of nuclear weapons. Is President Obama willing to take that risk? Well, he certainly hasn't been when it comes to Israel, and he wasn't last Friday when he had U.S. Ambassador Susan Rice veto a resolution that would have declared Israel's West Bank settlements to be illegal. The vote was 14-1, with America's close allies Britain, France, and Germany voting to censure Israel. Coming as it did in the midst of the Great Arab Uprising, in which his administration is desperately trying to assert its influence, that veto will surely rank as one of the greatest self-inflicted wounds ever committed by an American president. What Obama was telling the world was that he and his administration put the interests of Israel above those of the United States. It didn't help when on Sunday Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told ABC that Israeli settlements were illegitimate, but not illegal. Doesn't that remind you of when her husband Bill, trying to explain his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, said, "It depends on what the meaning of the word is." The American people, the Palestinians, and the world deserve better.